Hello everyone, you are now listening to episode 2 of The Call of Nature. This is a grassroots nature podcast for inverted commas normal people. On it you can hear our sounds and stories of UK wildlife, and then you can come on the show and tell us your stories. If you're new to the show, then welcome, it's nice to have you. And if you listened to episode 1, then welcome back. And thanks very much for all of your positive and encouraging messages on social media. Now, you've got your three regular hosts today. There's Pete, there's Dr. Gareth, and there's myself. Pete, very briefly, tell us your best nature moment since we recorded episode 1.
That's an easy one, Chris. I had an unforgettable moment today. I'm aware that a lot of my interest in nature comes from fishing with my family when I was a boy, so it's something I'm keen to get my little boy doing. He's just turned 5, and today I took him down to the Ship Canal, and he caught his first perch, and he was just so ecstatic. It's such a beautiful little fish, stripy, bright green, aggressive as hell. He got to look at its teeth, he touched its tail, he wouldn't hold it because of its spiny back, which is probably wise at the age of 5. But yeah, unforgettable moment for me today.
Oh, that sounds really cool. I vaguely recall catching my first fish when I was a boy. Gareth, what's your best nature moment since we last did this?
Well, mine was today as well, actually. Since lockdown has happened, I've turned into this like really rubbish Forrest Gump and just doing loads of running all the time. And I was running along the canal this morning, and there were like 10 swifts swirling around above it. And they were coming down. I saw one, it came down, that sort of thing where it glides over the surface and opens its mouth, and you can see it scooping up some water to have a drink and then sweep flying off.
Great.
It was amazing.
Wow. Yeah, there's certainly a lot of them around in this bit of the world at the moment. I think my highlight has really been my moth trapping. I've got a moth trap, and which catches moths, and me and my daughter go down and look at them in the mornings, and with this warm weather we've had a lot more success and a lot more things that aren't just like brown or grey. So I'll put some pictures up on social media of some of the more exotic looking ones. Pete, what can we expect to hear in the rest of this episode?
Lots of fun stuff in this episode. We've got Bob Smith from Scotland. He's a nature guide, very engaging, passionate about wildlife and entertaining, so I hope you'll enjoy that. Then we're going to hear from Gareth about a wonderful nature place that he knows. Next, Nikki Simpson talking about access to nature. That's a lovely interview. Then I'm going to tell you a bit more about a bird for the Chris's Birds feature.
Hang on. Are we calling it Chris's Birds?
I am.
Okay. It's stuck now.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
So yes, Chris's Birds. Then we've got Julie, our first listener, contributing. So that's very exciting, talking to Chris about silverfish. But before all that, we're going to hear from Chris himself on one of his late night activities with a beer and a bat detector.
It's just gone 9 o'clock, and I'm taking a walk up the lane by my house, up towards the cemetery. It's just getting dark. A bit weird thing to do, you might think. But what I'm trying to do is record some bats. Now, I was in a charity shop in town a couple of months ago, I suppose. I found in there a fairly basic bat detector. And what those do is they've got a microphone. Bats navigate by echolocation. So they make a really high-pitched squeak, which bounces off their surroundings, and then they have big ears. And you can hear that come back, a bit like a submarine, you know, and it gives them a sort of audio picture of where they are in their surroundings, and they do that very quickly with a set of clicks. That's how they find their way around in the dark. And these bat detectors, they pick up those clicks, and through some technological magic they can change the frequency to one which humans can hear. So I got one of those in the charity shop for £1.75. I'm sure it was worth it. In fact, I felt a bit bad because I looked it up on the internet after I bought it. No, I looked up in the shop on my phone to see how much it was worth new. Like 60 quid. £1.75. Winner. Got to love a bargain. Bats obviously emerge at sort of dusk and fly around catching insects, moths and the like. So I figured there's a farm down at the end of this road. There's a cemetery, lots of trees, lots of insects and stuff. So let me get out of my pocket. Hang on. I can hear a tawny owl off in the distance. With me. Right. Out of pocket. Let's turn it on. You can hear it makes that kind of hissing sound. In fact, it picks up the when I make S noises with my mouth. Oh, I can see back there. What it's all about. There might be a bit of silence until a bat flies over. If a bat flies over. Hear that? There we go, bats. I can't see that one. It's getting a bit dark. Now that is exactly what I was, and move it away from the phone a bit, but that's exactly what I was hoping to hear. That little kind of squirt sound at the end is when it's really homing, when it's got a moth or something sight as such, not sight because it uses sound, but it's honing in on it, it's getting really close to it. It really increases the frequency. Here we go, hang on. It's gone, that one. So it turns into that squelch as it gets closer and closer and closer, right up to the point where it can get more detail of where its prey is, so it can pluck it out of the sky. That's what that little squelch at the end was. Maybe we'll get another one. There we go. Yeah, it got quite close that time, but I can see it. That wasn't me farting. It sounded like it. My farts sound like many different sounds, but that was something plucking. That was a bat plucking something out of the air right in front of me. I think they're going up and down the lane. That's it. Okay. I say I think because I can't see them. It's too dark now. Cool. Thanks for listening.
Well, that sounded fun, Chris. Thank you. And Gareth, you're our resident expert. What's all the bats were they then?
That's putting me on the spot, isn't it?
It is.
I think it's probably a pipistrelle, and there's two different species you hear more commonly in Britain, and one sings at a slightly higher frequency than the other. Humans only had military radar, you know, for the last 70 years odd. Bats about 65 million years, so it shows how far behind wildlife we are in some respects.
Wow, amazing.
But anyway, yeah. That was Chris's attempt at nature guiding. It was good for a first attempt, but should we go across to someone who's been doing it for years as a proper professional? because the next interview came up was of Bob Smith, and it's fascinating. And have a listen to it, because I already want to know if they do a sat nav in his voice.
We're now joined by Bob Smith. So, Bob, thanks very much for chatting to us.
Very much my pleasure, boys.
Cool. Well, one of the things which we're asking a lot of our guests is what got them into nature and wildlife in the first place. So maybe you could start by telling us a bit about that.
My dad was a policeman years ago, and I used to just go out with him, and of course we saw so much wildlife, particularly 50 years ago, yeah. So I was out with him at the age of 3, 4, 5 year old sort of thing, coming across capercaillies, coming across wildcats, just totally smitten. And that's how it all kind of started for me. And then, of course, become a teenager and you discover wine, woman and song, and then everything goes pear-shaped after that. However, I'm now back into it, so thoroughly enjoying it. Absolutely thoroughly enjoying it.
For the benefit of our non-Scottish or less familiar with wildlife listeners, what's a capercaillie?
It's a big sod-off grouse, the biggest grouse we've got. Roughly about 2.5 feet, 3 feet tall in some cases. Huge animal, very reclusive, but very territorial come this time of year, sort of March, April, possibly even into May. And if you're walking past one, it will attack you. And it doesn't hang about. And like I say, something that size having a go at you is something a bit special, shall we say. I've almost lost one client through it, but there you go. That's a different story.
And you mentioned wildcats, Bob, very casually there. Isn't this an extremely difficult to see species?
It is now, without a doubt. When I stayed in a little village called Dunkeld, where my dad was the local policeman, and a lot of the gamekeepers round about, my dad was obviously visiting them for firearm licences, etc. And I'd sometimes tag along with him, not in his police duties, but if he was popping up to see the gamekeeper a later date for primarily fishing. But some of the gamekeepers' garages were absolutely covered in wildcat pelts. And there was, well, two particular gamekeepers that used to take me out, Gordon and Bob. And used to see, I wouldn't say we saw wildcats regular in these days, but you often saw them maybe once a week. Amazing, amazing creatures. They're very, very difficult to pick up, sort of watching them at a distance. But as soon as you start to see them, they disappear, you know, just like the Scottish tiger, eh? But, amazing, amazing creatures to watch. But they'd appear and then disappear just as quick, which was sometimes annoying. But yeah, we used to see them often, not regular, but often.
Earlier on, you mentioned your clients, and I think that's because you're now a professional nature guide. So tell us a bit about that.
I've been involved with sort of beaver tours since 2013, 2012 sort of time. And that kicked off other tours that people wanted. Clients wanted to see mountain hares, adders, pine martens. So I've built my own pine marten hide, and we're getting a variety of species visiting there, you know, woodpeckers, owls, a goshawk every now and again, and pine martens on a regular basis, which is absolutely brilliant. It's something I just love, and it's very close to my heart. Meet new people on a daily basis, and most people, because they've got a like mind, they want to see wildlife, enjoy themselves, you know, which is brilliant. Just love it. Absolutely love it.
That sounds an amazing resource you've got there, and not just for you and your clients, but for the local wildlife as well.
Yeah, we're very lucky in Perthshire. I know the Cairngorms everybody thinks the Cairngorms is a sort of Scotland's gem, but other than the crested tits, we've got everything and more in Perthshire. And it's amazing. It's absolutely amazing what we've got here, and you don't have to go particularly far. Most of my stuff that I do is within a 20-minute, half-hour drive. Some of it's within a 5-minute walk from the town. And, you know, it's absolutely amazing. And we've got some beautiful scenery. We're at the south end of the Cairngorms National Park as well. But go up there, that takes you half an hour from Blairgowrie, and that's you in the hills. And you're in amongst the mountain hares, you're in amongst the ptarmigan, red deer, grouse. The beavers are literally 5 minutes from me. And I think, just talking about clients, I've taken over 2,000 people to see the beavers. That was up to the end of last year. But obviously this COVID thing's knocked this year's tours Yes, we're going to have to wait a wee bit before we get that one going again. But yeah. But hopefully soon. Hopefully soon. We can just live in hope.
You mentioned you've got a pie martin hide. What's it like being in the pie martin hide?
It's just a little bit of heaven, as far as I'm concerned. At least from the Forestry Commission, it just works in really, really well. You're only 15 yards from the car to get to it, so anybody carrying heavy kit, you've not got far to go. You can get in there regardless of what ability you have as far as walking's concerned. You know, we've even had a girl in there that was in a wheelchair, which was lovely. Seeing her face when she saw her first pine marten, she never thought she'd ever see one live, and she managed to see it, and she was just absolutely, well, she was actually in tears, which was brilliant, you know, just tears of joy. So that was lovely, you know, it was really, really good. Yeah, so, yeah, it's a nice place to sit.
That sounds fantastic, Bob. And you've come on to something which is a particular interest of mine and something that we're really keen to discuss on the Call of Nature. And that is when people are brought closer to nature, the benefits that it has on them. And you must see this every day.
Oh, without a doubt. I did a talk for the local sort of mental health drop-in centre, Wisecraft. And the guys there, you know, some of them are I wouldn't say in a bad way, but, you know, they were having issues and whatnot. But going in and talking about nature, showing them presentations, you just see their eyes light up. And since then, I've done a few tours with them. I've taken them on walking tours through the local forests, through the woods, by the river. And that sense of well-being, just being out in space, breathing and forgetting about your normal day worries, is something that I hold very close. And you see it on my clients every day. As soon as they see a mountain here, it's like, oh my God, look, and it's so close. And you can see the worries and concerns that they've possibly had totally disappear. It's just a lovely experience. And being able to facilitate that, I think it's very important. And I know a lot of people go on about it, but this this green mind, you know, the well-being of a soul, I think a lot of it goes back to us when we were sort of cavemen or living in forests. We get a natural sense of ease when we're in a wood or at the sea or on a hill. You know, it's just that sort of getting back to nature and enjoying it, you know, just enjoying that moment in time. It's lovely.
Yeah, that's great, Bob. For people who might, you know, be living a long way away from Perthshire, for example, maybe in a city, what advice would you give them if they want to access some of the benefits that nature can bring?
So sometimes just a case of going and just sitting and waiting and just seeing what comes in, because it's amazing what's flitting about in the most obscure and surreal places. Well, you're talking about cities. There's another city beside me, Perth. It's got peregrine falcons in the middle of the town, or in the local church, which is, you know, you sit at Wetherspoon's pub, and the peregrine falcon's sitting above you plucking a pigeon. This church in St. John's, which is in Perth, the minister there was totally into his bird life, and he was so happy having this peregrine falcon in the spire. So he used to give all these sermons on the Sunday, this talk about, oh, peregrine falcons up here, we've got nature, this is la, 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 la. You know? And, of course, one Saturday, he had a wedding, so he did the wedding, and the bride walked out in her beautiful white dress and got splattered by a pigeon's head. So, yeah. So they had to wait until the birds had fledged, and then they put sort of gauze around where the birds had been nesting. But the birds are actually nesting on a local cliffside, which is just probably about a mile away, and they still come into the city and feed on the pigeons and use Wetherspoon's church now, or the old church that Wetherspoon's are in. Use that, which is, it's absolutely brilliant. You know, I've seen these fantastic birds so close and in one of our inner cities. So, yeah, in answer to your question, just sit and watch, because it's amazing. There's always something out there. There's always something out there.
The bride wouldn't have been too delighted about getting marks on her bridal gown.
No, she wouldn't. But,
no, I wonder if this couple took that to be an incredible and wonderfully portentous engagement with wildlife during their wedding, or whether they took it the view that it was more of a bit of a disaster for them.
I don't know. I certainly hope it was the former. But like you say, the bride probably wasn't too impressed. But looking back on it, it's a story for her that she'll be able to recite to her grandkids.
Bob was a really fun person to chat to. I loved how enthusiastic he is about stuff. I'd certainly love to get up and see some of the stuff that he shows people.
Yeah, I would as well. Also, we met Bob on Facebook, so if you've got interesting stories to tell, we'll come back to this later, but we'd love to hear from you via that route. Next thing, we recently asked Gareth if he would like to tell us about a fantastic nature place that he knows, and here's what Gareth came up with.
Okay, Chris and Pete, you've challenged me to come up for a wild place that's really special to me, and I've got to be honest, I found this really difficult. It reminds me of a guy I saw talk once called Matthew Oates, who's an absolute godfather in the world of butterflies. And one of the things he said is that when he died, he wanted his ashes spread around the special wild places around the country that he's been to. And this struck me as a great idea. I went home, I started making a list for myself, and it started getting really long. And I was thinking, you know, if I have some kids, they're going to be traipsing all over the country, dropping off bits of me here and there. But one of the places that came to the top of the list was someone that's really special to me, and it's called Bembridge Ledge. And I was born and brought up in the Isle of Wight. Bembridge is on the east point of the diamond that makes up the Isle of Wight. And the ledge is just off the south side of that. It juts out into the sea. It's sort of a limestone chalk bed of rock. And it's really important to me and really my family because I come from the Isle of Wight side from a line of fishing families for generations going back. And they used to go there and fish and capture crab and lobsters and sell them to rich Londoners coming down to the Isle of Wight. So it's a really important place for them. But for me, it's where I discovered like the world of marine life, really, because within the ledge, there's almost like a cutting in the rock where it's really safe to learn to snorkel and learn to swim. You know, the Isle of Wight, we didn't really learn to swim so much in swimming pools. We did a lot of learning in the sea. And this was the first place that I saw jellyfish. It's the first place that I saw fish out in open water. It's where I learned to snorkel. I mean, I'd seen all these programs on TV with people going like deep sea diving and seeing fish and tropical seagrass going past. And Bembridge Ledge, I actually got to see it for myself. I mean, there were different species of fish. It was bass rather than sort of, you know, clownfish. And the seagrass was a slightly different species. And I've got to say, it was an awful lot colder. But it was an absolute magical place. I remember seeing a flounder for the first time, scuttling along the seabed, kicking up all the sand. And when I was about 8, I had this thing called a beach bucket, which was nothing more than just a transparent bucket. But you could chuck some sand in there, put some stones in, get a bit of seaweed. You know, if you managed to pick up a hermit crab, you could pop it in and make your own sort of marine aquarium. And I thought that was absolutely brilliant. But this magical experience I had in the Isle of Wight, swimming around Bembridge Ledge for years as I was growing up, I didn't realise quite how lucky I was because the ledge is actually part of what's called an MCZ, which is a marine conservation zone. Now, we've got these all around the country because one of the things that is really special about Britain is actually its sort of marine habitat. Bembridge is one of these. And I had a little bit of a look at the things that I saw then, and actually loads of the things that I was seeing then as a kid turns out are really important. So they've got really important seagrass beds, these tall bits of, I mean, pretty much what you expect them to look like, tall bits of grass coming up from the seabed. They've got stalks of jellyfish there. So my first experience of jellyfish may well have been some of these quite rare jellyfish, which can only be found, some of them, in the UK. They've got rare seaweeds, like the one called a peacock's tail, again, that can only be found around some parts of the UK. And they've got this fantastic little seahorse, which I'll admit I didn't actually see myself at that age, but a short-snouted seahorse, which is a fantastic little creature. And a lot of naturalists will tell you the story, but other people might not know it. But seahorses have this really strange behaviour, which you don't see in many species, where it's actually the male that looks after the eggs and does a lot of the parental care. So the female will come in, deposit the eggs into a pouch in the male, who then fertilises them and basically lets them grow inside this pouch. So the male does all the hard work, which is fairly unusual in the world of animals. But anyway, Bembridge Ledge is a fantastic place. You can still go down there today and get down there snorkeling and see all of this wildlife. And it makes you appreciate that some of the stuff that's really special about Britain actually isn't on land, it's underneath the water.
That sounds great, Gareth. You must have loved growing up around there. I've got a question for you. Last I heard, these marine conservation areas, I think it must have been 5-10 years ago, we had 3 of them in the whole of the UK. Somebody told me that the volume of them was about the same as a tea bag in an Olympic swimming pool. Does that ring any bells? And has the situation now improved?
Well, I know around England there's 90 or 91 of these MCZs. Have you got to start somewhere? That's what I always say. And they're going to make a big difference. So I'm glad to see them, and it, you know, recognises that it's one of the things that's really important. And from my perspective, what I find quite funny is Bembridge Ledge, there is a bit I didn't include in that that's quite special for me, is that a lot of my family are sort of fishermen, naval, and they're sort of buried at sea. So Bembridge Ledge is where we scatter the ashes of like people in my family at the end of their life. So a lot of them are in an MCZ themselves.
I can think of worse places to be.
No, it's fantastic. Although there's a lot of rum has to go in with them because it's a naval thing.
Nice.
So moving inland now to somewhere that's completely away from the sea, we're going to talk to Nikki Simpson about urban wildlife and the importance of having really great wildlife places in our cities around Britain, particularly talking about her time in Birmingham. So it might feel like a million miles away from Bembridge Ledge, but there's some amazing stuff to see just if you keep your eyes open.
Thanks very much for joining us today. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing good, thanks.
Great. We haven't met before, Nikki, but I'm really looking forward to asking you my first question. I know we're all on lockdown at the moment, aren't we? But if given the choice, what sort of place would you head to today on a day off, would you say?
Well, out into the countryside, I'm pretty lucky that I get to sort of live in a fairly rural area. So get to go out into the countryside, pretty much just straight out from my doorstep. But I spent a lot of time working and living in Birmingham and seeing sort of families in that area that didn't really have the opportunity to go into the countryside or even any kind of nice green space, really. So I'm lucky to have a nice garden as well. So, you know, just being in the garden, the sunshine's lovely, or just going for any kind of walk on a public right of way, just into a field, just feels really nice to have that space.
I couldn't agree more, Nikki. And you mentioned Birmingham there. I think you were going to ask a question about things to do with that, weren't you, Gareth?
Well, I was just sort of wondering, like, you know, we're on lockdown and stuff, and like you say, you're lucky to live in a rural area, have a bit of a garden. I'm the same. I've got a little bit of a garden, although I live in a flat. When you go into sort of urban areas and you look at the green spaces there, I mean, do you think they're good enough?
No, well, spending a lot of time working in Birmingham, and some of the most urban areas of Birmingham and the Black Country, you've got sort of really dull parks that are sort of, you know, fenced around, and the grasses sort of mown within an inch of its life, and there's nothing really to inspire people. There's nothing really to look at. So, you know, when we got the opportunity to take families out to a little slightly more wild sort of green space, it was just great to kind of see the reaction on people's faces, to be able to just sort of discover mini beasts and flowers and trees and new things. You can see that everybody kind of loves that, really, but it's just not having the opportunity to experience it. And so many people in urban areas don't have gardens or, you know, any kind of space to get outside.
And do you think people are sort of starting to realise now how important that sort of, you know, local green space is now, that you're sort of all stuck and only being able to exercise close to our homes?
Yeah, I hope it makes people think a lot more just about the small things, really. You know, it doesn't matter how big a space is, but it's just, you know, even you can make a balcony sort of a bit more wild and a bit more interesting. So I think people are starting to notice things a bit more and appreciate what we've kind of taken for granted for a long time.
What would be your top tip for like making a little urban green space a bit wilder?
I think just kind of let it go wild, to be honest. Just let it go and see what's there. And just down the road from me, we were seeing the sort of grass verges getting really sort of wild and lovely with wildflowers in the past few weeks. And I noticed today that unfortunately the council have mowed them and they just look so much more dull. So just kind of let an area go wild and see what comes up. And given the time and space, you'll be amazed kind of all the different sort of flowers and insects that start to use it.
So in a way, it's almost like the right thing to do is to be a bit lazy and just let things grow.
Yeah, definitely. Well, yeah, be a bit lazy, see what grows, and then see what you've got, and then to have a think about how you can improve it.
And I guess, you know, we've all worked in the wildlife conservation sort of sector, but I mean, the sort of people you sort of were talking to and working with when you were in Birmingham and now in Gloucester, do you think that diversity is a problem for the conservation sector?
Yeah, I think so. And I just think it's maybe people not having the opportunity or thinking about conservation as a career or something that they can get involved in. You see most diversity, I guess, in some of the most urban areas where they haven't got a lot of green space. So perhaps there's less opportunity for people diverse from diverse backgrounds to engage with nature. But, you know, when they do, you see just the same reaction as everybody else, you know, amazement and interest.
Have you got any stories from sort of your experiences of, you know, where someone from a sort of a more diverse background sort of really discovered wildlife and the reaction it's been for them?
Yeah, well, we do. We in one of the most urban areas in Birmingham, a small heath, which is a really diverse area. We had a little education area, which is only really small. You couldn't really call it a nature reserve, but it was a sort of a green space that was much more wild than local parks. And we used to bring all the children. I used to run an after school club there, and we used to bring all the children from the local schools down there. And great reactions from people, you know, just on the simplest things that we would probably take for granted, like an oak tree. I remember even one parent actually not really knowing what an oak tree was, which you kind of, we're probably quite amazed about, you should know an oak tree. But, you know, this is the kind of, people don't have those opportunities to kind of see some of the really simple things that we take for granted. And the children just, as soon as they come into that green space, you can see them come alive and just run around. And I think particularly pond dipping and mini beast hunting. I don't know a child, I haven't met a child yet that doesn't enjoy pond dipping and mini beast hunting.
That's lovely, Nikki. So we know that what you like to do on your days off, we know that you've been engaging people with wildlife through your work, which is awesome. Nice one. Gareth tells me that you're also involved in volunteering. How does that work for you?
Yeah, I do quite a bit of volunteering. One of those people that sort of still does my day job on my days off, which is probably a bit sad. But, you know, conservation is my passion, like many of us at work. Yeah, we kind of enjoy doing it. And I get to the opportunity to do things that I wouldn't normally do in my day job. So I do some volunteering for a couple of marine conservation charities where I survey on ferries, looking at sort of marine mammals, cetaceans and seabirds. But I also volunteer for some non-conservation organisations as well.
What do you feel that brings to, is it the extra exposure to nature, or does that provide more for you?
Yeah, well, I think it's, you know, different exposure to nature that I don't normally get. Sort of, I grew up by the seaside, and now not living by the seaside, I kind of miss that opportunity to engage with marine wildlife. But my other volunteering outside of conservation, I do some dog walking for a charity, and I really kind of enjoy the helping people and helping sort of animals aspect.
So you find it a very rewarding experience then?
Yeah, definitely. Really kind of enjoy all the volunteering I do. And, you know, the charities I volunteer for kind of really believe in their ethos as well. So I think sort of, you know, doing something to help people and to help wildlife and animals, just feels really rewarding.
And if that's great. And if a listener felt like they might be interested in volunteering, how would you recommend they go about getting involved?
It depends what they're interested in, I suppose. I volunteer for a couple of marine charities, Orca and Marine Life, but my dog walking is for the Cinnamon Trust. But there's lots of other volunteering opportunities out there. I can't remember the website, but there's volunteering websites where you can search for different opportunities that interest you.
And Orca, I mean, that sounds really interesting, but I mean, do you need to be really skilled? I mean, do you need to have done a degree or something to be able to volunteer there? What sort of level of expertise is needed?
So with Orca, you have to attend a training course. You do pay for the training course first. But once you've attended that one day training course, then you start off as sort of an unexperienced surveyor, and you work with other more experienced surveyors to kind of build up your knowledge and confidence. So then you can progress if you want to. But marine life, you don't have to attend a training course. You just have to kind of show that you have a little bit of background knowledge and then just start again as an inexperienced surveyor and work with some more experienced people.
So you can really start of not knowing that much at all and just build up your knowledge.
Yeah, I mean, we definitely work with a lot of other volunteers that aren't, you know, don't work in the conservation background. They just have always kind of loved that type of thing. And, you know, sometimes it's retired people and they just kind of always loved it, but they've never had an opportunity before. And they're kind of making the most of the time they've got now to do all these things. So yeah, sometimes it's just people's, you know, hobby and interest, and they just get involved that way. So you don't have to have a degree and loads of knowledge. Yeah, anyone can kind of get involved.
Well, that's great, Nikki. I really admire you for doing the volunteering and the work that you do. Now, before we let you go, we're asking everybody that we interview on the Call of Nature for what we're calling at the moment, and it's early days yet, so we'll get to come up with a better name, but a magic moment, an exciting moment of wildlife that you can recall and tell us about. What do you think? Have you got one of those for us?
Yeah, definitely. Something really exciting that comes to mind is on a sort of survey, a volunteer sort of survey we did on the way to Jersey. And we were on the ferry surveying for cetaceans, marine mammals. And we had a pod of common dolphins pop up beside the boat. And there's probably about 50 or so dolphins in the pod. And it's just wonderful having dolphins go alongside a boat with you, because they just look like they're having so much fun. They're jumping out the water, playing, spinning. And, you know, to see sort of 50 common dolphins really close up was fantastic. But you did have to spend 4 hours surveying the boat, but actually probably 8 hours, but it's worth it.
Sounds like it.
It's been really interesting speaking to you, Nikki. As always, thanks very much for joining us on the Call of Nature, and keep up the good work.
Wow, that was really great. Thanks, guys, for chatting to Nikki. It was it's really interesting to hear about urban wildlife. Having spent a lot of time living in cities myself, I mean, I know that you don't need to be in the countryside necessarily to be able to have like really good access to nature.
So the other thing about cities is it's where most of us live, and it doesn't really matter from what background you're from in a city, you've got an opportunity to see wildlife. And it sort of links into something I'm quite passionate about at the moment, which is this Black Birders Week that's been launched in America. And it comes off the back of basically a black woman who was out bird watching, and a white woman called the police on her because she didn't know what she was doing. And like, it never happened the other way around. And I think it uncovers like a real challenge for the conservation sector, is that if you look around, volunteers, people who work in there, people who are passionate, there's a real lack of diversity. And it's something that this Black Birders Week is really pushing some barriers on, which is fantastic.
I mean, we're three white guys, so it's hard for us to, you know, necessarily say, you know, we empathise with this position, but it's really important for us to talk about it. And
So like everything with the Call of Nature, we want you to come on the show. If you're less of a white guy than we are, we'd love to hear your experiences and ideas. So please do contact us.
So from bird watching, we go to bird listening with our next bit, which is about bird calls. And Pete is going to tell us about one of his favourite animals.
Well, there it is, and I'm sure many of you recognise that sound. It's a bird which flies in from southern Africa into the UK and arrives in March or April every year. They leave in July or August, with the youngsters following them about a month later. And they've got some amazing skills. If you hadn't guessed already, it's the common cuckoo. Now, like I said, these birds are incredible. They lay their eggs in the nests of other birds, smaller birds than themselves, birds which are often predated by sparrowhawks, so it's no coincidence. It's thought that cuckoos have evolved to appear rather like sparrowhawks. They can actually make their eggs mimic those to a degree of the hosts that they parasitise. Their hatchlings, then, the minute they pop out of the shell, waste no time in chucking all the host's eggs out of the nest, leaving just themselves in there, leaving the hosts to raise another bird's young. And incredibly, the juvenile bird in the nest can actually mimic the sound of not just the host's young, but an entire brood of the host's young. So you end up with this almost comical looking dove-sized juvenile jammed into the nest of a reed warbler or a dunnock or one of those small birds that it parasitises, until eventually it ups and leaves and flies to Africa, presumably leaving the host birds wondering what the heck happened. So it's quite an amazing creature with a hell of a story. But sadly, as its habitats decline in Africa and the habitats of the hosts decline in the UK, it's a sound of the summer that I remember from when I was a boy, which is disappearing, much like that of the swift, and in fact, even more so. In fact, where I grew up in rural Hampshire, every year I can remember as a kid being a bit excited when they arrived and hearing that sound. And then gradually, as the months went by, it would start boring into your head. And actually, it used to get quite annoying by the end of the summer. That's how common they were. Well, not anymore. The last one I heard was when I was up in Dartmoor, as I was talking about in the last episode. Haven't heard one since. That's partly because I've not been to the right places, but sadly, mostly because that sound just isn't there anymore, which is a real reminder to all of us that we need to take the environment more seriously and protect these special creatures that we love and the places where they live, in my view.
I tell you what, Pete, I'd love the opportunity for cuckoos to become boring for me. I've had loads of people this year saying that they've heard cuckoos for the first time in like 10 years or 15 years. So hopefully there might be some sort of trend of them coming back. But one of the things we did, I did a little look at this. I thought, what can we tell people about cuckoos that's a bit more interesting, a bit more than they might ordinarily know?
A bit more interesting.
Sorry.
what can I tell you that's a bit more sciencey?
Sorry.
I love it.
Okay.
What did you find that was a bit more interesting?
Well, not much, because obviously that was a fantastic piece. But
thank you.
A bit more sciencey. So whether you hear the classic cuckoo sound, the male just sticks to that. When the female has this other call she can make, where it mimics a hawk. So what the idea is there's a little songbird there sitting on its nest, and then suddenly it hears a hawk. So it tries to fly away to sort of pull the hawk away from where its eggs are. But what it's actually doing is freeing up a space for the cuckoo to swoop in, deposit her egg, and let the reed warbler, whatever it is, raise her young. So what a sneaky bird that is.
That is sneaky.
It's amazing, like, just that they've learned. How do they learn? How do they learn to do that? I'm just amazed at how that behaviour can be learnt. So up next, we've got a chat that I had with one of our listeners who got in touch because she listened to the first episode and wanted to talk to us about a little insect called silverfish. So here's my chat with Julie. So Julie's got in touch with us today. Hi, Julie. You're from York, yeah?
Yeah, that's right. The beautiful city of York, yeah.
You've got in contact with us after listening to the show, and you got in contact via social media because you want to tell us about some weird creepy insects, is that right?
Well, yeah, because so many people don't like the weird little oddities, do they? And you know, I don't know, perhaps it's because I'm odd.
Story of my life.
Look, these little creatures called silverfish that I did, they're like these creepy little, you'd see them on Monsters Inc. or something as one of the bad guys maybe. But I saw them as a kid just by the fireplace pulling back the carpet, and it's like this little silver insect like scuttling along, and I was like, wow.
What do they look like then?
Well, they're like, they're really flat with like a little round head and a long tapered sort of body that goes to a point. And they're silver. I guess that's why they're called silverfish. And they kind of, I guess also the way they move is almost like they're swimming along, but they're sort of scuttling really.
So do they look like a little squirmy fish from the side then?
Maybe. Sort of. Yeah. They've got like little antennae at the front. And then these three little hairs at the back, and they're just super fast. And I remember like being like, what the heck is that? And then saying, you know, like, mum, what's this? And she was like, oh, that's a silverfish, my dear. And that started my enthusiasm for weird, creepy little insects. I wasn't very popular at school, obviously.
Oh, I'm sure that's not true. Like, if I wanted to see a silverfish, where would I find one?
Well, probably somewhere like quite damp. I think, you know, that we used to live in a bit of a damp old house with just the one wood fire. And so they like, I think they like dark places. Yeah. Sort of under the rug or behind the wallpaper, I've heard. I think sometimes they'll like nibble books and stuff like that. They like to eat sort of, you know, paper and woolen rugs and stuff like that. So people probably don't like this house, and if they saw one, they'd maybe freak out. Ah, what is it?
I know, like, you know, I can understand why people might see them as pests, but I quite like the idea of these things kind of like, you know, like, do you remember that book, The Borrowers? Remember that?
Yeah.
So like these that was when there were these little people. They were like miniature people, weren't they?
They lived in your house. Like the whole kind of own little world within someone's house. But it was like,
yeah, and took the stuff that they didn't really need. So maybe that's what silverfish do, right?
Yeah, I think they're probably misunderstood little individuals. And I guess they just, you know, it's safe in a human's house, isn't it? You don't get big birds coming to try and peck you. So why wouldn't you hide in the dark under a rug in the corner and only come out at night?
Yeah. And one thing you were saying earlier when we were chatting earlier on is how they're one of these animals that has been the same, you know, hasn't really evolved beyond where they are now for millions and millions of years.
There's been no reason for them to change. So it's kind of like they got it right first time, maybe.
Yeah, I love that. When dragonflies are similar things, aren't they? They haven't changed much for like millions and millions of years. They were dragonflies when they were dinosaurs, right? But I like the idea that you know. Oh, sorry, that was a blackbird going crazy above my head. I'm sat in my garden. There's a noisy wildlife all around me. I like the idea that they've been around for millions and millions of years, and then we've come along just in that last maybe 1 or 0.5% of their like
existence
history.
It's almost like they've adapted to us, you know, like they're like, yeah, what the hey, come on humans, we'll just adapt to your lifestyle and live in your house, that's perfect. And we probably don't even notice that they're there, do we?
No.
I have seen one here in the house I live in. I don't know if I've told really? My other half, actually. You probably would creep out if you knew.
Get rid of it.
Rip the floor up and kind of like get the exterminators in. But I don't mind living with a bit of wildlife indoors as well.
Julie, thank you very much for coming on and talking to us about silverfish. Hopefully... you'll come on again and talk to us about something else.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Julie, so much for contributing, getting in contact with us. We really appreciate it, and we hope other people will do the same. And it was really interesting. Unlike my bit on cuckoos, apparently.
Oh, don't get hung up on it. Just because Gareth like wanted to do his I'm a scientist thing. Yeah. That's right.
Well,
it's going to happen. I think.
And it was interesting. In fact, it was amazing. Thank you, Gareth.
It was interesting.
I'm sorry.
Well done, Gareth. Yeah, that was really fun chatting to Julie, and it was great because she got in contact with us after listening to the show. Now, if you've got a story that might be personal to you that involves nature or wildlife, we'd really love you to get in touch and share it with the rest of the people who listen to the podcast. There's a bit of an assumption that you need to be like really knowledgeable and have expertise on a subject to be able to talk about wildlife. You know, there's loads of shows on TV and radio where you can hear from experts, and it's great to hear from experts. You know, they're very good, but we want to kind of liberate the subject with nature and wildlife so that everyone can talk about it, and that's what this show is really about. It's about sharing a love of nature amongst like normal people, inverted commas, normal people like us. Not like Gareth. He is normal. He likes, you know, other stuff as well. But, you know, people aren't as engaged with nature as they used to be. And you can do something about it. You really can. You know, come on and share your passion for nature with us, your storytelling. It might be that you've got an encounter with wildlife that you want to recount, like Bob's beheaded pigeon story. Or you might have a special place in your community that you want to tell the world about, like Gareth telling us about his place on the Isle of Wight. Or it might be that you're an aspiring future David Attenborough wildlife presenter. And you can come and tell us about some fascinating creatures near you. Now, you don't need fancy technology. We do most of this podcast on cheap smartphones and creaking old laptops, which you can probably tell. but maybe, or, you know, maybe as well, you know someone else who might enjoy joining us on the show or making their own feature. But we'd really love to hear from you. This is what the show is about. So, yeah, get in touch.
More Julies.
Yeah, more Julies, please. One thing I meant to say on the last episode, but forgot, sorry, was to say thank you to Beth Granger, who did our artwork. Thanks very much. It is really good, and you did it for free. So thank you, Beth.
Yeah, thank you, Beth. We love it.
It's awesome. Cheers, Beth.
So that's the end of episode two. Thanks very much for listening to us. We hope you've enjoyed what you've heard. The next episode will be out in a couple of weeks' time. So please like, follow, subscribe, or whatever you need to do in however you find your podcasts so that you get notified when it's out.
Yeah, and thanks to everyone who shared the Facebook page. And I know people have sent the podcast to friends. So thank you all very much for that.
And get in touch, whatever you've seen exciting in the next couple of weeks. Just get in touch. We'd love to have you on the show.
We would. All right. Thanks, everyone. Bye.